Quranic and Biblical narrations. General outlines. A large number of subjects dealt with in the Bible are also found in the Quran. Firstly, there are narrations referring to the prophets, Noah, Abraham, Joseph, Elias, Jonah, Job and Moses, the kings of Israel, Saul, David, Solomon, to name just some of the main narrations they share in common. There then follow more specific accounts of great events in the course of which the supernatural has intervened, for example the creation of the earth and heavens, the creation of man, the flood, the Exodus. Finally, there is all that has to do with Jesus and his mother Mary as far as it concerns the New Testament. What reflections do the subjects dealt with in the two scriptures provoke when viewed in the light of our modern knowledge of them from extra-scriptural sources? Parallel 1, Quran and Gospel and Modem Knowledge. With regard to the parallel of Quran and Gospels, one must first note that none of the subjects referred to in the Gospels, which were criticized from a scientific point of view, see part 2 of this book, is quoted in the Quran. Jesus is referred to many times in the Quran, for example Mary's annunciation of the nativity to his father, the annunciation of the miraculous nativity to Mary, Jesus's stature as a prophet of the highest order, his role as the Messiah, the revelation he directs to man which confirms and modifies the Torah, his preachings, his disciples and apostles, the miracles, his ascension to God, his role in the Last Judgment, etc. Surahs 3 and 19 of the Quran, the second of which bears Mary's name, devote long passages to Jesus's family. They describe his mother Mary's nativity, her youth and the annunciation of her miraculous motherhood. Jesus is always called Son of Mary. His ancestry is exclusively given with regard to his mother's side, which is quite logical since Jesus had no biological father. Here the Quran differs from Matthew's and Luke's Gospels, as we have already seen, they give the paternal genealogies of Jesus which are, moreover, different from each other. In the Quran, Jesus is placed according to his maternal genealogy in the line of Noah, Abraham, and Mary's father, Imran in the Quran. God chose Adam, Noah, the family of Abraham and the family of Imran above all his creatures, as descendants one from another. 3:33-34. So Jesus is descended from Noah and Abraham on his mother Mary's side, and from her father Imran. The errors made in the naming of the ancestors of Jesus found in the Gospels are not present in the Quran, nor are the impossibilities in the genealogies contained in the Old Testament of Abraham's ancestry, both of which were examined in the first and second parts of this book. Once again, this fact must be noted if one is to be objective, and yet again its great importance appears very clearly in the face of the unfounded statements which are made claiming that Muhammad, the author of the Quran, largely copied the Bible. One wonders in that case who or what reason compelled him to avoid copying the passages the Bible contains on Jesus's ancestry, and to insert at this point in the Quran the corrections that put his text above any criticism from modern knowledge. The Gospels and Old Testament texts are quite the opposite, from this point of view they are totally unacceptable. Parallel 2, Quran and Old Testament and Modem Knowledge. In the case of the Old Testament, certain aspects of this parallel have already been dealt with. The creation of the world, for example, was the subject of a critical study made in the Old Testament section of this book. The same subject was examined with regard to the Quranic revelation. Comparisons were made and there is no need to cover this ground again. It seems that historical knowledge is too vague and archaeological data too scarce for parallels to be established in the light of modern knowledge on problems concerning the kings of Israel, who form the subject of narrations in both the Quran and the Bible. Whether or not one can tackle the problem of the prophets in the light of modern data depends on the extent to which the events described have left traces which may or may not have come down to us. There are, however, two subjects dealt with in both the Quran and the Bible which should command our attention and which need to be examined in the light of modern knowledge. They are as follows. The Flood. The Exodus. The first because it has not left traces in the history of civilization which support the biblical narration, whereas modern data do not permit us to criticize the narration contained in the Quran. The second because the biblical and Quranic narrations evidently complement each other in their broad outlines, and modern data seem to provide both of them with remarkable historical support. The flood. The flood, the biblical narration of the flood and the criticism leveled at it, a reminder. The examination of the Old Testament description of the flood in the first part of this book led to the following observations. There is not just one description of the flood, but two, written at different times. The Yahvist version, which dates from the 9th century before Christ. The sacerdotal version, dating from the 6th century before Christ, so called because it was the work of priests of the time. These two narrations are not juxtaposed, but interwoven so that part of one is fitted in between parts of the other, that is, paragraphs from one source alternate with passage from the other. The commentary to the translation of Genesis by Father de Vaux, a professor at the Biblical School of Jerusalem, shows very clearly how the paragraphs are distributed between the two sources. The narration begins and ends with the Yahvist passage. There are 10 Yahvist paragraphs altogether, and between each one a sacerdotal passage has been inserted. There are a total of 9 sacerdotal paragraphs. This mosaic of texts is only coherent when read from a point of view which takes the succession of episodes into account, since there are blatant contradictions between the two sources. Father de Vaux describes them as two accounts of the flood, in which the cataclysm is caused by different agents and lasts different lengths of time, and where Noah receives into the ark a different number of animals. When seen in the light of modern knowledge, the biblical description of the flood as a whole is unacceptable for the following reasons. The Old Testament ascribes to it the character of a universal cataclysm. Whereas the paragraphs from the Yahvist text do not date the flood, the sacerdotal text situates it at a point in time where a cataclysm of this kind could not have occurred. The following are arguments supporting this opinion. The sacerdotal narration states quite precisely that the flood took place when Noah was 600 years old. According to the genealogies in chapter 5 of Genesis, also taken from the sacerdotal text and quoted in the first part of this book, we know that Noah is said to have been born 1056 years after Adam. Consequently, the flood would have taken place 1655 years after the creation of Adam. The genealogical table of Abraham, moreover, taken from the same text and given in Genesis 11, 10-32, allows us to estimate that Abraham was born 292 years after the flood. As we know that, according to the Bible, Abraham was alive in roughly 1850 before Christ, the flood would therefore be situated in the 21st or 22nd century before Christ. This calculation is in strict keeping with the information in old editions of the Bible, which figures prominently at the head of the biblical text. This was at a time when the lack of human knowledge on the subject was such that the chronological data contained in the Bible were accepted without question by its readers, for want of any arguments to the contrary. How is it possible to conceive today of a universal cataclysm in the 21st or 22nd century before Christ which destroyed life on all the earth's surface, except for the people and animals in the ark? By this time, civilizations had flourished in several parts of the globe, and their vestiges have now come down to posterity. In Egypt at this time, for example, the intermediate period followed the end of the Old Kingdom and preceded the beginning of the Middle Kingdom. In view of our knowledge of the history of this period, it would be absurd to maintain that the flood had destroyed all civilization at this time. Thus, it may be affirmed from a historical point of view that the narration of the flood as it is presented in the Bible is in evident contradiction with modern knowledge. The formal proof of man's manipulation of the scriptures is the existence of the two texts. The narration of the flood contained in the Quran. The Quran gives a general version which is different from that contained in the Bible and does not give rise to any criticisms from a historical point of view. It does not provide a continuous narration of the flood. Numerous surahs talk of the punishment inflicted upon Noah's people. The most complete account of this is in Surah 11, verses 25-49. Surah 71, which bears Noah's name, describes above all Noah's preachings, as do verses 105-115, Surah 26. Before going into the actual course taken by events, we must consider the flood as described in the Quran by relating it to the general context of the punishment God inflicted on communities guilty of gravely infringing His commandments. Whereas the Bible describes a universal flood intended to punish ungodly humanity as a whole, the Quran, in contrast, mentions several punishments inflicted on certain specifically defined communities. This may be seen in Surah. We gave Moses the scripture and appointed his brother Aaron with him as vizier. We said, "Go to the people who have denied our signs." We destroyed them completely. When the people of Noah denied the messengers, we drowned them and we made of them a sign for mankind. We destroyed the tribes of Ad and Thamud, the companions of Ras and many generations between them. We warned each of them by examples and we annihilated them completely. 25:35-39. Surah 7, verses 59-93 contains a reminder of the punishments brought upon Noah's people, the Ad, the Thamud, Lot, Sodom, and Madian respectively. Thus the Quran presents the cataclysm of the flood as a punishment specifically intended for Noah's people. This is the first basic difference between the two narrations. The second fundamental difference is that the Quran, in contrast to the Bible, does not date the flood in time and gives no indication as to the duration of the cataclysm itself. The causes of the flooding are roughly the same in both narrations. The sacerdotal description in the Bible, Genesis 7, 11, cites two causes which occurred simultaneously. On that day all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened. The Quran records the following in Surah 54. We opened the gates of heaven with pouring water. And we caused the ground to gush forth springs, so the waters met according to the decree which has been ordained. 54:11-12. The Quran is very precise about the contents of the ark. The order God gave to Noah was faithfully executed and it was to do the following. In the ark, load a pair of every kind, thy family, save this one against whom the word has already gone forth, and those who believe. But only a few had believed with him. 11:40. The person excluded from the family is an outcast son of Noah. We learn, Surah 11, verses 45 and 46, how Noah's supplications on this person's behalf to God were unable to make him alter his decision. Apart from Noah's family, minus the outcast son, the Quran refers to the few other passengers on board the ark who had believed in God. The Bible does not mention the latter among the occupants of the ark. In fact, it provides us with three different versions of the ark's contents. According to the Yahvist version, a distinction is made between pure animals and birds, and impure animals, seven pairs, that is, seven males and seven females, of each pure species, was taken into the ark and only one pair of each impure species. According to a modified Yahvist verse, Genesis 7, 8, there was only one pair of each species, whether pure or impure. According to the sacerdotal version, there was Noah, his family, with no exceptions, and a pair taken from each species. The narration in the Quran of the flooding itself is contained in Surah 11, verses 25-49 and in Surah 23, verses 23-30. The biblical narrative does not present any important differences. In the Bible, the place where the ark comes to rest is in the Ararat Mountains, Genesis 8, 4, and for the Quran it is the Judi, Surah 11, verse 44. This mountain is said to be the highest of the Ararat range in Armenia, but nothing proves that the names were not changed by man to tally with the two narratives. This is confirmed by Arblacher. According to him there is a peak in Arabia named Judi. The agreement of names may well be artificial. In conclusion, it is possible to state categorically what major differences exist here between the biblical and Quranic narrations. Some of them escape critical examination because objective data are lacking. When, however, it is possible to check the statements in the scriptures in the light of the established data, the incompatibility between the biblical narration, that is, the information given on its place in time and geographical extent, and the discoveries that have contributed to modern knowledge is all too clear. In contrast to this, the narration contained in the Quran is free from anything which might give rise to objective criticism. One might ask if it is possible that, between the time of the biblical narration and the one contained in the Quran, man could have acquired knowledge that shed light on this event. The answer is no, because from the time of the Old Testament to the Quran, the only document man possessed on this ancient story was the Bible itself. If human factors are unable to account for the changes in the narrations which affected their meaning with regard to modern knowledge, another explanation has to be accepted, that is, a revelation which came after the one contained in the Bible. The Exodus. With the Exodus from Egypt of Moses and his followers, the first stage of their move to Canaan, we come to an event of great importance. It is an established historical event which appears in a known context, in spite of occasional allegations one finds which tend to attribute to it a largely legendary character. In the Old Testament, the Exodus forms the second book of the Pentateuch or Torah, along with a narration of the journey through the wilderness and the alliance, covenant, concluded with God on Mount Sinai. It is natural for the Quran to devote a great deal of space to it too. An account of the dealings Moses and his brother Aaron had with the Pharaoh and of the exit from Egypt is found in more than 10 surahs containing long descriptions, for example surahs 7, 10, 20 and 26, along with more abridged versions and even simple reminders. The name of Pharaoh, the main character on the Egyptian side, is repeated, to the best of my knowledge, 74 times in the Quran in 27 surahs. A study of both the Quranic and biblical narrations is especially interesting here because, in contrast to what has been noted in the case of the flood, for example, in the main, the two narrations have many points in common. There are certainly divergences, but the biblical narration has considerable historical value, as we shall see. This is because it helps to identify the pharaoh, or rather the two pharaohs in question. This hypothesis, which starts with the Bible, is complemented by the information contained in the Quran. Modern data are added to these two scriptural sources, and it is thus possible, through a confrontation between the Bible, the Quran and today's knowledge, to situate this episode from the Holy Scriptures in a historical context. The Exodus according to the Bible. The biblical narration begins with a reminder of the Jews' entry into Egypt with Jacob, who joined Joseph there. Later on, according to Exodus 1, 8, now there arose a new king over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. The period of oppression followed. The Pharaoh ordered the Jews to build the cities of Pitom and Ramesses, to use the names given to them in the Bible, Exodus 1, 11. To avoid a population explosion among the Hebrews, Pharaoh ordered each newborn son to be thrown into the river. Moses was nevertheless preserved by his mother for the first 3 months of his life before she finally decided to put him in a rush basket on the river's edge. The Pharaoh's daughter discovered him, rescued him and gave him to a nurse, none other than his own mother. This was because Moses's sister had watched to see who would find the baby, had pretended not to recognize him and then recommended to the princess a nurse who was really the child's mother. He was treated as one of the Pharaoh's sons and given the name Moses. As a young man, Moses left for a country called Midian where he married and lived for a long time. We read an important detail in Exodus 2, 23, in the course of those many days the king of Egypt died. God ordered Moses to go and find the Pharaoh and lead his brothers out of Egypt. The description of this order is given in the episode of the burning bush. Aaron, Moses's brother, helped him in this task. This is why Moses, once he had returned to Egypt, went with his brother to visit the Pharaoh who was the successor of the king under whose reign he had long ago been born. The Pharaoh refused to allow the Jews in Moses's group to leave Egypt. God revealed himself to Moses once again and ordered him to repeat his request to Pharaoh. According to the Bible, Moses was 80 years old at this time. Through magic, Moses showed the Pharaoh that he had supernatural powers. This was not enough, however. God sent the famous plagues down upon Egypt. The rivers were changed into blood, there were invasions of frogs, gnats and swarms of flies, the cattle died, boils appeared on men and animals, there was hail and plagues of locusts, darkness and the death of the firstborn. Nevertheless, the Pharaoh still did not allow the Hebrews to leave. They therefore broke out of the city of Ramesses, 600,000 of them besides women and children, Exodus 12, 37. At this point Pharaoh made ready his chariot and took his army with him, and took 600 picked charioteers and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, pursued the people of Israel as they went forth defiantly. Exodus 14, 6 and 8. The Egyptians caught up with Moses' party beside the sea. Moses raised his staff, the sea parted before him and his followers walked across it without wetting their feet. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. Exodus 14, 23. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not so much as one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Exodus 14, 28-29. The text of Exodus is quite clear. Pharaoh was at the head of the pursuers. He perished because the text of Exodus notes that not so much as one of them remained. The Bible repeats this detail moreover in the Psalms, Psalm 106, verse 11 and Psalm 136 verses 13 and 15, which are an act of thanks to God who divided the sea of rushes in sunder, and made Israel pass through the midst of it, but overthrew Pharaoh and his host in the sea of rushes. There can be no doubt, therefore, that according to the Bible, the Pharaoh of the Exodus perished in the sea. The Bible does not record what became of his body. The Exodus according to the Quran. In its broad outlines, the narration of the Exodus contained in the Quran is similar to that of the Bible. It has to be reconstituted, however, because it is made up of passages dispersed throughout the book. The Quran does not provide a name which enables us to identify who the reigning Pharaoh was at the time of Exodus, any more than the Bible does. All that is known is that one of his counselors was called Haman. He is referred to six times in the Quran, Surah 28, verses 6, 8 and 38, Surah 29, verse 39 and Surah 40, verses 24 and 36. The Pharaoh is the Jews' oppressor. When Moses said to his people, "Remember the favor of God to you when he delivered you from Pharaoh's folk who imposed upon you a dreadful torment, slaughtered your sons and spared your women." 14-6. The oppression is recalled in the same terms in verse 141, Surah 7. The Quran does not, however, mention the names of the cities built by the Jews in subjection, as does the Bible. The episode where Moses is left by the riverside is recorded in Surah 20 verses 39-40 and Surah 28, verses 7-13. In the version contained in the Quran, Moses is taken in by Pharaoh's family. We find this in verses 8 and 9, Surah 28. The family of Pharaoh took him up. It was intended that Moses should be to them an adversary and a cause of sorrow. Pharaoh, Haman and their hosts were sinners. Pharaoh's wife said, "He will be a joy to the eye for me and you. Don't kill him. He may be of use to us or we may take him as a son." They did not sense what was to come. 28-8-9. Muslim tradition has it that it was Pharaoh's wife Asiya who took care of Moses. In the Quran, it was not the Pharaoh's wife who found him, but members of his household. Moses's youth, his stay in Madian and marriage are described in Surah 28, verses 13-28. In particular, the episode of the burning bush is found in the first part of Surah 20, and in Surah 28, verses 30-35. The Quran does not describe the 10 plagues sent down upon Egypt as a divine chastisement, unlike the long description in the Bible, but simply mentions 5 plagues very briefly, Surah 7, verse 133, flooding, locusts, lice, frogs, and blood. The flight from Egypt is described in the Quran, but without any of the geographical data given in the Bible, nor the incredible numbers of people mentioned in the latter. It is difficult to imagine how 600,000 men plus their families could have stayed in the desert for a long time, as the Bible would have us believe. This is how the death of Pharaoh pursuing the Hebrews is described. Pharaoh pursued them with his hosts and the sea covered them. 20:78. The Jews escaped. Pharaoh perished, but his body was found, a very important detail not mentioned in the biblical narration. God is speaking. We took the children of Israel across the sea. Pharaoh with his hosts pursued them in rebellion and hostility till, when the fact of his drowning overtook him, he said, I believe there is no God except the God in whom the children of Israel believe. I am of those who submit themselves to him. God said, What? Now? Thou hast rebelled and caused depravity. This day we save thee in thy body so that thou mayest be a sign for those who come after thee. But verily, many among mankind are heedless of our signs. 10:90-92. This passage requires 2 points to be explained. The spirit of rebellion and hostility referred to is to be understood in terms of Moses's attempt to persuade the Pharaoh. The rescue of the Pharaoh refers to his corpse because it is stated quite clearly in verse 98, Surah 11, that Pharaoh and his followers have been condemned to damnation. Pharaoh will go before his people on the day of resurrection and will lead them to the fire. 11:98. For those facts which can be checked with historical, geographical and archaeological data therefore, it should be noted that the Quranic and biblical narrations differ on the following points. The absence in the Quran of place names, both of the cities built by the Hebrews in Moses's group, and on the route taken by the Exodus. The absence of any reference to the death of a pharaoh during Moses's stay in Madian. The absence in the Quran of details concerning Moses's age when he addressed his request to the pharaoh. The absence in the Quran of the numbering of Moses's followers. These figures are openly exaggerated in the Bible to incredible proportions, said to have been 600,000 men plus their families forming a community of more than 2 million inhabitants. The absence of any mention in the Bible of the rescue of the Pharaoh's body after his death. For our present purposes, the points to be noted because they are shared by both narrations are as follows. The confirmation contained in the Quran of Pharaoh's oppression of the Jews in Moses's group. The absence from both narrations of any mention of the king of Egypt's name. The confirmation contained in the Quran of the Pharaoh's death during the Exodus.